All over the world, young men are coming to power. Men who are not bound by the traditions of the past. Young men who can cast off the old slogans and the old delusions.
As we know, 50 years ago today, Brookline-born John F. Kennedy, a young man himself as the country's 35th president, was assassinated in Dallas, Texas, on his way to give a speech. Over the past several weeks, WBUR has been looking back at the Kennedy presidency in our series called November 1963. This morning, WBUR's David Boeri reports on why so many Americans, including those not yet born at the time of his death, are still drawn to Jack Kennedy a half century later.
What is it in the end that still draws us? John F. Kennedy seems more like a dream drifting across the ages than a figure of history.
Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans.
His inaugural address inscribes his graveside memorial. We recite his speeches. He's a young man who never grows old. Surely that's part of what draws us.
Story itself of the young prince being gunned down, that story is irresistible.
Writer and biographer Richard Reeves.
What keeps the legend going is he was the first president whose entire life was photographed and filmed and televised.
Historian Nigel Hamilton is one of many biographers who sought to capture the elusive Kennedy.
He had this charismatic personality together with this terrifically photogenic face, that huge broad smile that electrified people. He looked always so natural.
He carried himself with a cool grace which seemed indifferent to applause, wrote Norman Mailer. Kennedy was detached, a war hero, rolling in family money. He was a matinee idol, a prince, and his wife was ravishing.
We've all seen them. All those marvelous pictures of him and Jackie has made him the glamour boy of American history.
Says Richard Goodwin, one of Kennedy's White House staffers. Americans were drawn like magnets. Women wanted to dress like Jackie. Men wanted to dress like Jack. When he stopped wearing hats, we stopped wearing hats.
There was a freshness to him. It's the best way I can describe it.
Michael Dukakis is a former governor of Massachusetts.
Both physically and in terms of what he was saying, that was very new, very different, and for many of us, enormously inspiring.
Young Mike had just taken the bar exam when he and a friend drove a Carmen Ghia from Boston out to the 1960 Democratic Convention in Los Angeles. The country they crossed at mid-century was mired in the Cold War and a color line, the search for communists and conformity and the dread of nuclear annihilation.
I mean, with all due respect to Tom Brokaw, spare me this Greatest Generation stuff. This country was racist. It was anti-Semitic. The divide between rich and poor, which is bad enough as it is today, was huge.
But standing before that convention was a candidate who claimed, we can do better, and told Americans, only you can decide what you want to do with the future.
And we stand today on the edge of a new frontier, the frontier of the 1960s.
In accepting the party's nomination, Kennedy invoked the pioneer's spirit. It was a generational frontier where the youngest man to be elected president tapped into the well of energy and hope buttoned down by the 50s and by the elderly Dwight Eisenhower, then the oldest president in history.
My call is to the young in heart, regardless of age, to the stout in spirit, regardless of party.
Onto the field, Kennedy rode with soaring rhetoric and athleticism. He was gifted with his opponent, Richard Nixon, a gloomy, heavy-browed dark knight who, even when he won debates, was outshone by the white knight. Liberals wistfully remember this as one of the great boon moments of American liberalism. The campaign song swung with optimism, and no one less than Sinatra sang it.
K-E-double-N-E-D-Y, Jack's the nation's favorite guy. everyone wants to back Jack. Jack is on the right track.
There was an atmosphere of hopefulness, and I think people today can understand that atmosphere if they think about the way they felt in 2008 about Barack Obama.
Robert Ross co-founded Students for a Democratic Society, better known as SDS, in the early 60s.
Something different was going to happen, and it was going to be better. There was a moment of peak hopefulness.
Ross, now a professor at Clark University, remembers a late-night crowd of thousands at the University of Michigan before the election as Kennedy challenged them to public service.
How many of you who are going to be doctors are willing to spend your days in Ghana, technicians or engineers? How many of you are willing to work in the Foreign Service and spend your lives traveling around the world?
Inspired by Kennedy, some students coined the phrase Peace Corps.
Thousands of Michigan students signed that petition, asking the president to create a Peace Corps.
Which Kennedy accepted and created by executive order in his early days of office. For Ross, this was a high point of a president who would vex and disappoint him and other progressives. Yet, Ross says, people make the history they need, and so they transfer to the dead president their own hopes for what never came to pass.
What we would have hoped for is what we see as our memory of John Kennedy.
Biographer Richard Reeves calls Kennedy only a moderate liberal, a Cold War liberal.
His inaugural address was a call to war, and there were only three words in there on domestic affairs.
At the urging of an advisor, Kennedy added those words in a passage about America's commitment to human rights at home and around the world.
The only great cause at that time, aside from Cold War stuff, was economic growth. He did turn finally to civil rights,
says Dick Goodwin. But it wasn't until June 1963, and after waves of violence, that Kennedy publicly came down on the side of justice over order and called for integration.
He didn't go as far as some people wanted at that time, but he was moving in that direction.
A number of Kennedy's actions challenge his image as liberalism's standard bearer. He raised Pentagon spending to 50% of the federal budget, cut taxes on the rich and on capital gains, gave the green light to CIA plots to kill Castro, and sent 16,000 military advisors to Vietnam. Yet, Richard Reeves calls him a relatively effective president.
We were farther away from World War III at the end of his presidency than we were at the beginning, and I think that's an accomplishment.
He was skeptical of the generals. He brought us out of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he negotiated a ban on atmospheric nuclear testing. A week after he was assassinated, his wife told a historian, Theodore White, that at night she had often played the Broadway musical Camelot for her husband. It was his favorite.
Don't let it be forgot that once there was a spot for one brief shining moment.
That was known as Camelot.
For his family, his loyalists, and the party faithful, Camelot became the label and the prevailing image for Kennedy's brief presidency and the means for shaping the writing of history.
It's an emotional nostalgia.
Biographer Nigel Hamilton.
It's the notion that there was a time, a sort of fairy tale past, where everything was wonderful.
Had Kennedy lived, he would have saved us from the tragedy of Vietnam, liberals like Michael Dukakis claim today. Others believe he would have saved us from the bloodshed and turmoil of the 60s. Hooey, says Dick Goodwin. There is no way of knowing such things.
It wasn't so much what he did, but the spirit of triumph that he had. He made us feel that we were better than we thought we were.
In the end, what we know is that he was young and gifted. He spoke of ideals, a future we could choose, and of hope, which still draws us close. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm David Boeri.